friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sunny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's kick off with a controversial move by World Football's governing body, FIFA, and the governance of the sport in Africa. FIFA's first female Secretary General, Senegalese Administrator Fatma Samora, will oversee African football for 6 months, beginning Thursday, August 1st. The 56-year-old Samora will check the Confederation of African Football's finances and other vital documents in the wake of corruption scandals. For reaction, Iron Mike Mbonye spoke with the publisher of the online sports newspaper, Sports Village Square, Kunle Salaja.
That kind of stand is very unprecedented in the annals of continental football anywhere. I am surprised, I'm shocked. One, I see it as colonization of Africa again. Every member of the CAF Executive Committee, because if the president or the Secretary General have been found wanting in their responsibilities, what the Executive Committee of CAF will have done was to put these people under trial, and if they are found wanting, suspend them, and then let the next most senior person to continue running the administration, even if it is has to be in acting capacity. But what has happened now is that virtually everybody on that executive committee has one skeleton or the other in their cupboard, and that is why none of them is deemed good enough to continue the administration. If Ahmad had been found wanting in terms of the administration of CAF, it's unprecedented. And I imagine if the Secretary General of FIFA had not been an African, they would have seen somebody outside Africa controlling African football body.
Fatma Saura, the Secretary General of FIFA, is coming to run the affairs of CAF on behalf of FIFA. Do you see the present executive committee blending with her or working with her to ensure success in her new assignment?
They will certainly work with her because it was an invitation that they extended to FIFA to send her as a FIFA delegate to run for 6 months the affairs of CAF. I see them well with her, but I still query the rationale behind it. It means that nobody in that executive committee is clean or good enough to run football. If the woman is to come and do forensic analysis, forensic investigation of the finances of CAF.
If at the end of the 6 months and the assignment is over, what do you suggest should happen to the present executive committee of CAF? What should be done to them? Or which way out after the 6 months?
Well, depending on what the woman discovered, if it is discovered that there has been fraud, then that means they have to be flushed out. But I know from investigation that what they actually wanted, they wanted Ahmad to be out because Ahmad has been found wanting on many grounds. And then there is nobody among them that they feel will be good enough. And the initial plan I gathered was to make Fatima Samora, to stand in for an election, and then she will just be the CAF president. But I also learned that the woman was not well disposed to that because she felt that that would be a demotion for her, being a chief executive of FIFA body like FIFA, and then coming to run CAF.
That's Kunle Salaja, the publisher of the online sports newspaper Sports Village Square. And Kunle spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Lagos, Nigeria. We heard Kunle say that he sees the move by FIFA as colonization of Africa again. On July 18th in Cairo, on the eve of the Africa Cup of Nations final, FIFA President Gianni Infantino rejected comments that FIFA has taken a colonialist attitude towards African football.
And we've been working together in the last 3 years, and we have turned around all together FIFA with Fatma So what more can we do at FIFA than sending our top administrator with a team of experts to Africa to help? What more can we do? Tell me. I've been hearing about colonialization, that FIFA is colonializing Africa again. This bad FIFA. When Fatma Samoura was appointed Secretary General of FIFA, I didn't hear the opposite. I didn't hear that Africa is colonializing FIFA. What does it mean, colonialization? I don't know. It's not part of my vocabulary.
That's FIFA President Gianni Infantino speaking earlier this month in Cairo, Egypt. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. In more football news, the Frenchman Hervé Renard is Saudi Arabia's new head coach. The Saudis touted Renard's African football success in making the announcement, saying he's the first coach to lift the Africa Cup of Nations trophy with two different teams. The 50-year-old Renard guided Zambia to the Nations Cup title in 2012, and 3 years later, he won it again with Ivory Coast. Renard stepped down as Morocco's head coach earlier this month after the team's early exit from the Nations Cup in Egypt. Renard says he's happy to start a new adventure in Saudi Arabia on a new continent. Jill Ellis is stepping down as the head coach of the world champion U.S. women's national soccer team. The 52-year-old Ellis is the only coach in history to win consecutive Women's World Cup trophies. Earlier this month in France, the top-ranked American women won their fourth World Cup title overall with a 2-0 victory over the Netherlands. Jill Ellis says the timing is right to move on. Well, she'll officially move on in early October after guiding the American women on a 5-game victory tour. Ellis says the opportunity to coach the U.S. team and work with amazing women has been the honor of a lifetime. Jill Ellis has worked for the U.S. Soccer Federation in one capacity or another since 1999. She was named head coach of the U.S. women in 2014, and since then has compiled an overall record of 102 wins, 7 losses, and 18 draws. Perhaps even more impressive, Jill Ellis never lost a Women's World Cup match. 13 victories and 1 draw. Let's give a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Jill Ellis, who led the U.S. women's national soccer team to back-to-back World Cup titles.
You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
And my Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you Wednesday night at 18:30 UTC GMT with another edition of Straight Talk Africa. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. One goal, a coach, a team, and the game that brought a divided town together is an inspiring story about soccer, Somali refugees, and a town in the U.S. state of Maine. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's listen in to my VOA colleague Adam Phillips's interview with the book's author, Amy Bess.
The game is the game of soccer, the most global of sports, but it's also about a very specific game that took place in the fall of 2015 when the Lewiston Blue Devils went to seek their first state championship title in soccer with a very different kind of roster.
Tell me a bit about Lewiston.
Lewiston, Maine was a largely French-Canadian town, a former factory town, textile industry. The bottom fell out when factories closed and moved out of the Northeast. So it was a town that had seen better days. And in 2001, a couple and then a couple hundred and then a couple thousand Somali refugees found their way to Lewiston, taking advantage of available apartments. It had high vacancy rates and good schools and a safe community to begin to continue their lives and raise their families in the United States. And some of these kids found their way to the soccer team. Soccer's a passion. And this story is about this coming together of community and family and team in this quest for this state title and what it means to this community and what it represents. You know, community is not just about statistics. It's also about a feeling of home and a feeling of belonging. And that's a priority here.
Still, you said there were lots and lots of growing pains, at least at first. I mean, it's hard to think of two cultures that are more different than the Somalian culture these people came from and the native New Englanders they found in post-industrial Lewiston, Maine.
No, I mean, on the surface, this is very much a fish-out-of-water story. You know, people's reaction is, why are there Africans in Maine? It's such a cold state. It's an overwhelmingly white state. In the early days, you had moments like when the former mayor wrote an open letter to the Somali community saying, you know, we support you, but please tell your friends and family to stop coming. We can't have any more. And so that's a painful moment, but it's followed by a coming together, a giant rally that the community puts together to sort of say, no, you know, we are many and we are one.
So there's something a bit more to it than either the two groups polarizing or sort of becoming one homogeneous group without distinctions.
It's really a negotiation amongst different peoples to find a path forward. And there's a lot of culture clash, but Maine has the oldest median age in the United States. And to have folks who are interested in laying roots and raising families and having their families raise families was a shot in the arm that Lewiston needed in terms of attracting business and attracting industry in a city that hadn't seen that for a very long time, in a state that doesn't see that.
Of course, it's not really equivalent, but both the Lewiston community and the Somalis had both experienced trauma and displacement. The Somalis, obviously, because of war and famine, etc. But the Lewiston folks had also been through a lot. I could understand, perhaps, why, at least at first, there might have been some resentment against the refugees.
Lewiston has had decades and decades of white intergenerational poverty, has some of the poorest neighborhoods in Maine. And there is that sort of competitive, what are these new people getting that I'm not getting?
So all this is great background to know about the growth and integration within the Lewiston High School. I know there were lots of racist slurs and things that opposing teams used, but it seems like people got together pretty well within Lewiston itself.
Somalis started coming onto the team in the mid to early 2000s, just a few at a time. And the book sort of details some of those early players coming on and different kinds of accommodations that the athletic department had to think about in terms of, you know, diet and Ramadan and how to integrate players and create relationships amongst players. But slowly, the Somali players began to dominate the varsity roster.
I know that soccer wasn't such a huge deal at all in Lewiston before the Somalis arrived, then began to really shine, correct?
Lewiston, it's a championship hockey town. It's a championship cheerleading town. And slowly, soccer was becoming a marquee sport. They make it to the state championship in 2014. They suffer a devastating loss. And, you know, the day after that loss, the next season begins because they are determined that they're going to be the ones to bring this city its first championship in this sport. And it's really an all hands on deck kind of effort. We have the high school coaches working, but the families and the supporters of the team. We see community organizations, you know, Somali founded community organizations are sponsoring soccer programs and supporting youth. We see a bridging of cultures amongst coaches, you know, the longtime head coach of the high school team hiring Abdi Jabbar Hersey, the first Somali hired by the Lewiston Athletic Department. He is the son of Abdullahi Abdi, who is sort of the coach of everyone in the city, a mentor of everyone. So it's really about thinking about what these kids in this community bring to the game. And it isn't that soccer replaces hockey in this main city. It's that now it's a hockey and soccer town.
I know the culture of soccer in Somalia is very different than the American competitive sort of individualistic style that we're used to. And that really helped bring a great spirit to the Lewiston team.
You know, they work very hard to make the team a team of the whole. You know, the bench players are as prioritized as the players who are on the field. This is a team who scores in such awesome capacity that as soon as they're up by five, the starters are pulled and the next line goes in and the next line goes in. And soccer becomes something that you have to work really hard at. You know, 25 years ago, soccer was something that you might have done to get into shape for your hockey season. And now if you want to play soccer and you want to be on the varsity roster in Lewiston, you better be playing all day, every day and studying the game and really taking it in, because it's no longer an easy team to just roll onto.
Give me a sense of the build-up to the epic game of 2015, the championship game. There must have been a lot of anxiety among Somalis and native-born Mainers alike, not to mention the townspeople.
Yeah, there was tremendous pressure with the 2015 championship, and I think my favorite chapter in the book is going through with each of the players about what that morning was like, waking up in Lewiston and thinking about the game that lay ahead of them and the pressure of trying to bring this city its championship. But I think that the most remarkable thing about that day is that there's 4,500 people in the bleachers of Fitzpatrick Stadium. You know, it's the most ever to sit for a soccer game in Maine. It's more people than show up the following week for the football championship. And you have those kinds of numbers. You're not talking just about the parents of the players and the friends of the players. You're talking about the community, a significant representation of the community. So they got to experience for those 90 minutes what it was like to be together, to have a we moment instead of an us versus them moment.
Sounds like a classic American success story. The immigrants who become Americans seemingly overnight almost.
I think that this story is very different because usually we talk about assimilation and Americanization and fitting in. And I think that Lewiston is really a negotiation in which all sides have to learn from each other to find paths forward together. It isn't about erasing who you are when you arrive to fit into this thing that we call America. It's about how to still know language and culture and food and tradition while living in America, and how you can take something like a common passion for a sport and use that. I mean, one of my favorite things that the players say about coach is that he doesn't care where they're from as long as they pass the ball. You know, that's a great sort of daily mantra to take away. If you're doing what you're supposed to be doing together, you can learn from that and live with that.
Give me a couple of examples, maybe of a Somali immigrant or refugee and a native-born Lewiston person who really exemplifies this sort of coming together or mutual negotiation that you're talking about socially.
I think one of the most interesting characters in the book is it's Shobo Saban, someone who played for Lewiston in 2007, 2008, 2009, as the roster was beginning to fill with Somali kids. And he was the only Somali on his eighth grade team. He made friends with Johnny McDonough, a fellow teammate who had sort of taken an interest in Shobo because he was wearing soccer jerseys to school every day. He's really one of the first kids that forges this path of how to hang out with people who aren't exactly like him. So I think that those kinds of examples of team, playing together, being together, and creating relationships that work on the field and off the field is a heartening thing to look at.
And you mentioned this sort of mutual accommodation we found on and off the team within the high school really translated into sort of palpable prosperity for the town. It's sort of on its way back now. These two comeback stories sort of reflect each other, don't they?
Yeah, it's thriving in a way that I think city planners hadn't envisioned. There's all of these entrepreneurial dreams that are coming to life when you walk down Lisbon Street. You have a mix of variety stores and grocery stores and clothing shops and tax services and, you know, an upscale coffee house on the one hand, mixed in with stores that are selling 40-pound bags of rice and green bananas and hijabs. It's a global experience to walk down Lisbon Street. It is a Main Street USA, but in a way that probably the city administrators didn't envision.
You have so much passion for this subject. It seems like it's really been very inspiring for you to work on all this.
It has. This project started as conversations about Syrian refugees and, you know, was the United States open or not open to be sort of that place that people could see as a beacon and who the United States is, because those conversations are now framed in terms of quotas and walls. And so I think that whether it be a soccer story or the story of this obscure season for this obscure team in Maine, America needs to remember who it is.
That's Amy Bass, the author of One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. And Amy spoke with my VOA colleague, Adam Phillips, in New York. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Turning to tennis, the City Open Tournament here in Washington saw three American women, all top draws for the fans, all lose their first round matches on Tuesday. Top-seeded Sloane Stephens, second-seeded Madison Keys, and 15-year-old phenom Coco Gauff were all beaten in straight sets. Stephens fell to Sweden's Rebecca Peterson 6-2 and 7-5. Keys lost to 17-year-old American countrywoman Haley Baptiste 7-6 and 6-2. Haley, by the way, was born here in Washington. And Coco Gauff lost to Zarina Diaz of Kazakhstan 6-4 and 6-2. At the post-match news conference, Coco said she was delighted with the cheers she heard from the fans.
I'm really happy for the support that I've gotten here, and it was a sad way to finish the singles run, but I really love DC, and I hope to be back at this tournament in the future.
In terms of the immediate future, Coco says she'll be focusing on next month's U.S. Open in New York.
I'm just going to be training at home until the U.S. Open, basically. So, yeah, that's it. Not that I know of no other tournaments. I don't think I have anything coming up.
Meanwhile, South African player Lloyd Harris, who we heard from on Tuesday's show, lost his second-round match here in Washington to 13th-seeded Kyle Edmund of Britain, 6-1 and 6-4. The players here in Washington, many of them, like Coco Gauff, are using this hard court tournament at the W.G. Fitzgerald Tennis Center in Rock Creek Park to warm up for the U.S. Open. That gets underway at the end of August. South Africa's two-time Olympic champion, Caster Semenya, says she's very disappointed to be kept from defending her 800 meters world title, but she'll continue to fight for the human rights of all female athletes concerned. The 28-year-old Semenya issued the statement after Switzerland's highest court ruled the South African athlete must follow rules passed by TRAC's world governing body, the IAAF. Those rules would require her to undergo hormone therapy to compete in certain women's track events, reversing previous rulings that allowed Semenya to compete, pending her appeal. Caster Semenya has said she will not undergo the hormone therapy, and her legal team says the latest court decision will prevent her from defending her world title in the 800 meters at the World Championships in Qatar, which will be held from September 27th to October 6th. The court decision also raises question marks about whether Caster Semenya will compete at next year's Olympics in Tokyo, Japan. Today, July 31st, marks 1 year to go until the athletics action begins at Tokyo 2020. This VOA programming note, Dan Friedel will be hosting the show August 1st, August 2nd, and August 5th. And that wraps up the July 31st edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to my producer this evening, Nadia Taha. Thanks also to VOA engineer Rob McLean. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
just in. All of July, Border Crossings is having a very special CD giveaway. If you're looking to listen to the top songs of the summer, we've got the CD for you. Every weekday, we'll be giving away Now That's What I Call Hits and Remixes 2019. Hooray! The CD presents an 18-track lineup of this year's top singles and remixes to date. You'll have access to the hottest artists of the summer, including Taylor Swift.
Are you ready for it?
Marshmello and Selena Gomez.
I've been running through the jungle, I've been running with the wolves to get to you.
Shawn Mendes.
There's nothing holding me back.
Maroon 5.
Can you turn around? Can you turn around? Just wait.
And so many more. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time all of July to be able to listen to the top hits all summer long.
Hello, it's the weekend. You deserve something special, and I've got just the thing. A spicy, sweet platter of the best Pan-African music on earth. This weekend, you'll hear an exclusive interview with Kagwe Mungai from Kenya.
My name is Kagwe Mungai. I am, as you've said, a singer-songwriter. I'd like to call myself an entertainer.
Wonderful old and new tunes from 10 different countries, including the official 2019 Africa World Cup theme song. And Song of the Week with Kwame Ofori is Oh My Love by Zambian sister duo Da Vows. So spice it and sweeten it up with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa. This Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 20.500 UTC.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization says the emergence and rapid growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, known as superbugs, are a serious worldwide health concern. Most scientists have placed the blame in the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria on the overuse of antibiotics to treat both humans and livestock for various ailments. New research conducted by British and Spanish scientists have found evidence that cigarette smoke can cause MRSA superbug strains to become even more resistant to antibiotics. The researchers found that the cigarette smoke stresses MRSA superbugs. The stress causes the already antibiotic-resistant bacteria to send out emergency signals, which increases the rate of mutation in microbial DNA that produces robust and tenacious variants that can better resist antibiotics. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
The economic and political turmoil in Venezuela continues, despite international efforts to support interim president Juan Guaido against strongman Nicolas Maduro. Host Carol Castiel discusses the Venezuela turmoil with Eric Farnsworth, vice president of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Mark Feierstein, former National Security Council director of Western Hemisphere Affairs. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Encounter.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, India's election results. For the second time in a row, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of the BJP Hindu Nationalist Party emerged victorious. Given Modi's strong Hindu nationalist leanings, will secular India turn into a Hindu nation? We'll examine it all next on Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
More than 1 million Uyghurs, Muslim minority in China, are currently held in Xinjiang internment camps, referred to as concentration camps by human rights organizations and former detainees, while Chinese officials describe them as vocational education centers. Carol Castiel discusses the deplorable treatment of Uyghurs in China. Listen to Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News.